Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to do part two of our topic on reparation. Last week, our guest, Dr. Makini Chisom-Straka, provided insight into reparation for Africans and African descendants, specifically looking at the experiences of Black Americans. Based on the transatlantic slave trade. Today, we're going to be looking at what reparation means to Africans in the African continent. Our guest, we have a very special guest, is Commissioner Shepo Madeleine Gozi. He's a professor. Professor Madeleine Gozi is presently the Commissioner for Anti-Racism, Justice and Education at the South African Human Rights Commission. He was also formerly director and associate professor at the Center for Applied Legal Studies, Wits University, South Africa, amongst many other roles. Commissioner, I'm very pleased to have you join me, and I look forward to a wonderful conversation.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let's start. What does reparation mean to Africans in the African continent?
Well, first of all, it is a sense of acknowledgement. You know, there has not been any serious acknowledgement by those who turned Africans into a commodity. So in the first place, it is a sense of acknowledgement that that this has happened. Because as you know, there are people who are revisionist historians who are trying to revise history, you know, about what really transpired. So in the first place, we demand reparations because it is about being truthful to what happened. In the second place, it is a sense of historical justice. You know, it cannot be that, you know, some people were dehumanized in order for profit making, in order to develop other nations, and that underdevelopment and development has become intergenerational. So as the famous book said, Europe underdeveloped Africa through colonialism, through land dispossession, through slavery, enslavement. So secondly, it is about historical injustice that Africa is where it is today as a whole from a developmental perspective, because you took the best of us, the most fit of us, you know, to develop your country. So it is about historical injustice that is ongoing. That's why we say we don't want aid. We don't want aid. We demand reparations. Of course, you can say our leaders have also made some mistakes. Some of them have been neo-colonialists. Some have engaged in corruption. There's a number of reasons why Africa is underdeveloped. But at the central historical base level, the underdevelopment of Africa is caused by, you know, this historical injustice that is not just about slavery, you know, it's about transportation of people in the transatlantic slave trade. It's about land dispossession. It's about conquest. It's about the deliberate, you know, underdevelopment of Africa. So in the second place, it's about historical injustice, which is economic, you know, which is about development. Thirdly, it is cosmological. It is about the fact that what the West did to Africa really severed us, cut us off from our historical memory, from our frame of reference, from our gods, from our, you know, from our spirituality. So it's not just economic. It is also cosmological. It's also spiritual. So what reparation do, the word reparation, is a repair, not just monetarily. If we say colonialism, conquest, dispossession, dismembered, cut us off. Reparation is about remembrance. R-E-membrance. It's about remembering, making us whole, cosmologically, historically, spiritually. So reparations, you know, it means a number of things, but at the heart of it, reparations is important for us as Africans for those three reasons. Number one, an acknowledgement. An acknowledgement of what happened. Can you just, and it's not just about apology. We don't care about apology. Apology is fine, but apology must be followed up with something. What are you apologizing with? Number two, it is about material acknowledgement and material compensation. Not only to compensate us, but to level the economic playing field. Africa was far ahead when conquest, colonialism, slavery happened. You know, with the Benin Empire, you know, with the Zulu Empire, with so many empires, Mabubungwe empires. Those were not people who were coming to the West with begging bowls. These were cities, Timbuktu, and so forth. All of those were destroyed by colonialism, conquest, you know, dispossession, and slavery, enslavement. Then lastly, for us, reparation is about making us whole again at the cosmological, spiritual level.
Brilliant. This is very broad, because those that look at reparations, I don't know if this is done deliberately, always look at it from a very narrow lens. Look at us if it's economic reparations, which is also very important, you know, from, it's one of the things you've mentioned. But one of the things you said that I want to, another book you referenced is Walter Rodney, that was talking in 1970, that was talking about how you lived underdeveloped Africa. And let me start from the point of acknowledgement, because those that have done that have refused to categorically acknowledge. And some of the reason is acknowledgement sometimes put the burden of responsibility. You know, acknowledging means by the time you acknowledge, then you can be liable to litigations and all of that. And then they tend to then revise their history. But if I look at the relation, if I look at the in South Africa, and then I'm looking at the post-apartheid, and I'm looking at the Truth Commission, and can I be a model for those that are trying to not acknowledge the wrongdoing? Because in South Africa, the Truth Commission has always been looked upon as a model. So how can that help in this conversation of reparations to those that are refusing to acknowledge, even acknowledge the wrongdoing?
So let me answer in two ways. Number one is to say, after a period of atrocities, a period of brutalities, a period of conquest and war, or even civil war, it is important, even at home, you know, within the family, After conflict, it is always important to pause, even before you move forward, to pause and say, number one, what happened? I think this is what happened. What do you think happened? How did what happened affect you? So that there is a common understanding of what happened. So that we don't lie about history. So it's about, you know, having a common narrative so that we can move on as a society, as a family, as the globe. So a looking back process is always very important. Number two, a process like that, that leads to not only the truth of what happened, but that leads to reconciliation and healing is very, very important, because somebody will be hurt, somebody will have resentment, somebody will have, you know, the right to be upset, to be angry, to be bitter. And that relationships have broken. Or in the case of settler colonialism, there was never relationship, but now you are here. We don't wish you to go back to England, whatever, you are here, but we must be a nation. We must come together. So a process of, you know, reharmonization, to harmonize ourselves, very important. But you must have the third letter. So not just truth, reconciliation, there must be a J, justice. T-R-J. Truth is not enough. Reconciliation is not enough. I use an example that I heard from a priest that I like a lot. And this priest gave me this example to say, somebody comes to your house, they steal a bicycle from you. Yes, later they come to you and say, yes, later. I am very sorry for what happened. And they're sincere. They look in the eye. I am sorry. You think about it and say, yeah, okay, I forgive you.
Then they say, but where's the bicycle?
And they say, okay, sure, bye-bye.
Bye.
But where's the bicycle? Number two, I've not had the use of the bicycle for 20 years. I've lost economic opportunities. I've been inconvenienced. My children today are beggars because they do not have this tool that they could use. So poverty has been intergenerational. So justice is important. Justice is very, very important. So yes, I support a TRJ process, but not like the one that happened in South Africa. In South Africa, as you know, there's a lot of myth making about the TRC. There's a lot of dishonesty about the TRC. A feel good about the TRC. I'm critical of the process that eventually happened. It had to happen, but not in the manner that it happened, but also not with these outcomes. The outcomes are that we still don't know the truth in South Africa. There are people whose loved ones are still, you know, have still disappeared 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Up to today, they don't know where those loved ones are. They know they were taken by the police. They don't know where they are. I worked with these people for 13 years, you know, these mothers and these fathers, these wives, this husband of people who disappeared. And one of them told me that, you know, every day at 5 o'clock, they look at the door for the past 30 years. Because, you know, the husband used to come back at home at 5 o'clock from work.
Five, yeah.
Every day, they still, you know. And as you might know, in our culture, you need to have closure. You need to bury something.
Yeah.
It's not closure unless you bury something. Unless you have cried. You know, how do you cry when the bones are still not there? Do you have truth about why some communities were targeted more than others? We don't have truth about informers who informed against our own comrades. You know, I worked with women who were sexually assaulted by their own comrades in exile in the underground by the not by the apartheid system, but by their own comrades. And they said to me, you know, Tshepo, those people are in parliament today. Those people are in cabinet. These dudes, I didn't know what to do, you know? So betrayal, the truth about who betrayed you and how and why. So there's still a lot of distrust. We don't get the truth about, you know, why white people are so rich and we are so poor. We know the truth, but some people pretend that it's about hard work and some people are lazy. It's about luck. It's about alcoholism and so forth. So we don't have the truth. We don't have reconciliation. We don't have reconciliation in South Africa, you know. I'm a commissioner for anti-racism and we deal with a lot of racism issues, even today. And as I always say, I don't really care. I care, but I don't, you know, what is important is not just interpersonal, you know, conflicts, about institutional and structural racism that continues. So we still don't have reconciliation. We still don't have justice. We still don't have justice. You know? South Africa is the most unequal country in the world. That should tell you something. More unequal than Bangladesh, more than unequal than Sudan, more unequal than Lesotho, more unequal than Colombia, more unequal than China. The most unequal country in the world, and it is a historical inequality. So please, if we are going to have this process at the global level, let it be a process rooted in honesty. Honesty, first of all. Please, let's be honest. Let's not just say, let us not just say there was conflict. There was conflict. No. There was no conflict in South Africa. There was colonialism. There was conquest. It's dishonest just to say there was conflict as if two equal parties were fighting. That is unfair. That is historical gaslighting, to use the term that the young people use. It's gaslighting. You know? It's collective amnesia. You know? So, no, a TRC that is dishonest, that is limited in scope, time frame, that is not ongoing, because this process can never be finalized, right? It must be ongoing. Don't say our process was only for 2 years. My goodness. 1996 to 1998. When South Africa, more than other African countries, was colonized longer than other African countries. Most African countries were colonized for 60 years, 50 years. You know, from the late, you know, 1850s.
Mid 20th century, yeah.
That's right. So let's go from 1652, as long as the Latin Americas, you know, when Columbus colonized or
America,
so-called discovered.
Discovered.
South Africa was going through the same process, 1652. The first conflict was 1510. And then you have this short process of 2 years, you know? So no, part of my job as a commissioner of anti-racism is to push South Africans to be honest. And that's a very difficult thing, because people say, but as a commissioner, you need to bring us together. Yes, come together on the basis of honesty. You know, my position is anti-racism. Anti-racism is not non-racism. Anti-racism is an active process of, you know, de-racializing society. So at the global level, we can de-racialize, we can de-apartheid by honesty and by justice.
There's something you mentioned that could be seen as an irony, and I think that needs to be reconciled. And I think that is one of the things that the revisionists have always used. The narrative about, number one, at the historical level, they will say, hold on a minute, there were internal people that are complicit. You mentioned the comrades that were not the white that were raping these women, that were sexual abusing this. They would say, hold on a minute. Before we came, the Arabs were there. Before we came, there was, you know, conquest within Africa itself, within among yourself. And then you bring it to the contemporary times. You could say, well, even among yourself, you're not, you know, so it's internal, like you mentioned, corruption among the leaders as well. So how do you reconcile these narratives with, because that shouldn't also remove the facts from the macro, what the colonialists did. But how do you reconcile this, those that use this narrative to justify, you know, their position against?
So they are sellouts because of the system, right? There were Africans who were complicit in what? In transatlantic slavery. There would not have been internal accomplices if there was no transatlantic slavery. There would not have been informers if there was no colonialism and apartheid in South Africa, right? Human beings are complex. There will always be people who side on the side of oppressors. Germany paid a lot of money to Jewish people as reparation, rightly so. Now, you can read books by a lot of French writers, a lot of German writers, a lot of Polish writers who talk about people in Poland, in Germany, in, you know, elsewhere, who were complicit with the Nazi regime, who pointed out where the people were hiding. But that argument has never been used, not to pay reparations. Has never been used, you know? We know in every conflict, there is a section of the oppressed people who, because of monetary corruption, which corrupts their soul, or because of fear, they end up, you know, selling out. We know that. But as you use the word macro level, at a macro level, we will deal with our people. I will deal with my son who has done the bad things in my house. But let's address this issue first. We'll deal with each other internally. That's our business. Don't tell us how to deal with my business, and how to deal with my friend who betrayed me. That's not your business. That's my business. You know? If you did not come here and corrupt my brother against me, that would not have happened. What is the sine qua non? What is the, you know, the causation of this? So it's true that there were empires that, you know, became complicit in slavery because of this. In Europe, there was also slavery internally. It's human nature, it happens. Transatlantic slavery is unprecedented in the history of the world because it was based on dehumanization. Not just we conquer your people because of war. We come, we are fighting, we conquer some of your people, and we make them work for us. That happens everywhere as part of fighting and looting, you know? But dehumanization, these people are not human beings. That's unprecedented. That is very, very serious. The Irish, you know, were conquered, but I don't think it was at a dehumanization level, you know, the Irish, not to diminish it, please, I should not be misunderstood. It's unprecedented at the level that it led to the drainage of, you know, our kings, our chiefs, our fittest warriors. Our farmers who then farmed in the Caribbean, these colonists could not know how to, you know, farm cotton, sugar cane, and so forth. They were useless, you know. They took the best from us, and that led to a direct relationship between the collapse of our society, taking our healers, our doctors, our priests, you know? So it's unprecedented, and the consequences continue today. Yeah. We deal with our people. We don't deny that there were people who were complicit, people who took their people and sold them. We don't deny that, right? But they sold them to who? To people who came far away with the explicit, you know, objective to, you know, turn other people into commodities. So we'll deal with our people, but, you know, and people always also say, where will that money go to? Where will that money go to? We just are corrupt. You know, they will steal that money. We will deal with our leaders. You know, it's like people who are saying, we want to return the
state artifacts.
The artifacts that you stole, because you don't have museums to
ever. You need to put them.
If you put them, they're going to be damaged.
It's quite ironic. When I hear this argument, I laugh at this argument. But there's something you mentioned that is quite unique. But I'm going to mention there are two questions. This is two double questions. You know, the last guest, I asked her this question, and she couldn't answer. But I think I've got an answer from you've really been able to answer. But I wanted to expatiate on it. You mentioned the cosmological, because I did say to her, I said, how do you deal with the psychological impact? Because sometimes we focus on the economic. How about people that have been, they've lost their language? They, like, you look at the French, the Francophone speaking, they've literally lost their language, lost their name. How do you deal with the psychological? And that's why you've been able to really talk about the spiritual, cosmological impact of it. But I don't think, in my opinion, I don't think the colonizers, those that have done it, can reparate that has to be internal. So how do you, I wanted to see if you can expatiate on that. How do you think one can lead? Because in Africa, you know, unfortunately, we didn't, whatever they used to say, we didn't have, we're not literate. We didn't, it was oral. You know, you talked about our healers that were stolen. How do you recover this? How do we get to that spiritual connection? How do you do this?
So there is a fellow called Steve Biko. Steve Biko was a Black consciousness leader in South Africa. B-I-K-O, Steve Biko, who was Black consciousness. Consciousness. And Steve Biko, you know, said, let's not fight now. Let's not go fight the colonizers now. Let's deal with ourselves first. Let's decolonize our minds first. Before we even ask for reparation, before we even demand, you know, liberation. So the short answer is that, as you say correctly, no one is going to repair you at a psychological level, at a psychic level. The work of decolonization becomes very, very important, you know? So we deal with that, first of all, by an intentional collective process of decolonization. Frantz Fanon, you know, has got two famous books. One is The Wretched of the Earth, The Damned of the Earth. And the other one is Black Skin, White Mask. Right? And that book, Black Skin, White Mask, was saying, and that was his first book, his first famous book, to say, we need to acknowledge for ourselves that we are messed up, that we've assimilated the colonizers' views about us, to the point that we don't think we've got gods, we don't think we've got history, we don't think that we've got a knowledge system and epistemology. We don't think that we are human beings ourselves. We don't think so. We measure our humanity according to a white, heterosexual, middle class man. And that, if I'm like that, I'm a human being. So it starts with us saying, before we demand reparations, Have you repaired yourself? Have you paid reparation to yourself? And part of that is to acknowledge that I'm messed up. You know, I'm a big believer in meditation, for example. And I try to meditate every day. A chance for me to sit down and say, I'm going to be doing a lot of difficult work today. But I need to approach that work holistically. You know, am I correct in my head before I do anything? So part of the reason why we have neo-colonialism in Africa is because our leaders, they were jealous of colonizers. They were jealous. They didn't see it as an injustice. They were jealous. Hey, these guys have got big houses. So the first thing that they did was to step into the shoes of the colonizers, as we say. There's only one leader in Africa who did not move into the governor's house. All of them moved into the governor's house. Can you believe it? That a liberation leader moves into the governor's house, the palace. Okay, maybe they changed the name. They give the name into an African name, you know? Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe some of them painted with African colors. But they literally stepped into the shoes of the colonizers. Only one of them did not do so. So let it be a museum, you know? Because they are neo-colonialists because they did not decolonize their minds. So before we demand acknowledgement, we don't demand rehumanization from colonizers. We don't demand recognition from colonizers. You know, this demand for recognition, Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter to who? Why are you so concerned? Black life must matter to you. You know? You know, as Black men, do we respect Black women's lives before we demand, you know, the life of other people, from other people? So don't demand rehumanization. We don't demand recognition, because to demand recognition from other someone is to say there's a hierarchy. He bestows
on you.
He bestows on you, you know, recognition. No. So the work of reparation must start with an individual. That's what all of our best leaders teach us. W.E.B. Du Bois. Double consciousness. The first thing is to overcome double consciousness. Transfer known. You know, talks about returning man to himself. You know, that's why he was a psychiatrist in the first place. Right? You know, that book, Black Skin, White Mask, you know, he goes through all this process and it ends in the final chapter with him crying. He cries in the final chapter. Because his recognition is not given by the other side. So that's why the last book, The Damned of the Earth. The first chapter is called On Violence. And it starts with the line, colonialism is violent, decolonization is violent. Meaning that we'll have to fight. We'll have to fight.
I think it was him that was talking. I think it was Frantz Fanon that said, looking at the case of Algeria with the French, and he was talking about the independence that Africa got is just flying.
And
independence you go without fighting for it is just flag flying. But there's something you mentioned that I agree to some extent, but also I want to say you mentioned intentional collective process. You mentioned that. So even though individual at the individual level one needs to go, but I think at the educational level, there needs to be, because sometimes I queried. Because I did my first degree at the University of Lagos. And when I went back, I was querying the professors. I'm like, why are we still using the Mungo Park curriculum? Why are we still doing some courses that are not relevant? You know, so I would say at that educational institutional level, which is what I was going to come to, my question. You mentioned institutional and structural racism, and that also is similar to what the former guest was talking about policy reparation. Now, it's not all this give money. It needs to come at the institutional level. You need to, racism is quite structurally rooted. So the change should come at the structural level. What would that look like in Africa? If we're talking about structural change.
Yeah. So you'll recall that Thabo Mbeki and Obasanjo came up with something called, amongst others, but those two were at the forefront. Okay. NEPAD.
Yeah, I know NEPAD.
NEPAD stands for what? New partnership for Africa. And they were saying there's a need to renegotiate the global relationship, new partnership. A new partnership that is based on a recognition of global apartheid. Thabo Mbeki called it a global apartheid. A new partnership that recreates multilateralism, right? That the United Nations, you know, must be reformed fundamentally. You know, it's not true that the United Nations is a united nation. It still perpetuates global apartheid itself. I'm not even talking about the World Bank. I'm not even talking about the IMF. I'm talking about the United Nations. Security Council, all of them, you know. So our leaders must start by saying we demand a new partnership. NEPAD, by the way, that dream has is still
is
there.
It's
not that serious. But in Mbeki, so that new partnership is a partnership that says we demand a new partnership that is not based on, you know, patronage, that is not based on aid, that is not based on we are coming to develop to shame you underdeveloped people. A favor is based on historical injustice. Let's come to the table. You did us wrong. We demand a new partnership based on this following. You know, write off our debts. We don't owe you anything anymore. You know, return our artifacts, return our minerals. You know, and so forth and so forth. And then number three, policy change, reformulating the international system, not just international law, which we know that international law still perpetuates imperialism and neocolonialism at the global level. So policy change, very, very important. So at the short to medium term, material compensation, reformulation of the partnership, at the long-term level, policy change based on this new partnership, right? But Mbeki had a prior step before NEPAD. Before he came up with NEPAD from 1995-96, he came up with something called the African Renaissance. The renewing of Africa. And what was what about? It was about let's retrieve our history. Let's retrieve our knowledge system. Let's retrieve our God. Let's repair ourselves. You know, let's equalize ourselves even before we demand a new partnership. You know, Thomas Sankara was all about that. Before he stood there and say, we demand the writing of debts and all that, and just were laughing at him. It's a YouTube video where he says, African leaders at the AU, at the OAU then, let's go there and demand the erasure of our debt, the eradication of our debts. And all the other leaders were laughing at him. This young man doesn't know what he's talking about because they were so colonized. For them, it's all about favors. So it would mean that at the policy level that Africans themselves said we are the rebirth of Africa based on the retrieval of our epistemologies, our dignity ourselves. We are retrieving our dignity, you know? That's what Thabo Mbeki went very close with Timbuktu to retrieve that manuscript, that historical university, and so forth and so forth. And then number two, once we have done that, then we can demand a new partnership based on equal footing, not a favor, equal footing, equal footing that is preceded by historical justice, reparations at a historical level, and then in the long term, policy shifts and policy formulation that will sustain this new partnership, that will sustain this equal relationship.
Do you think, I don't know if you agree with me, so there are two things. Do you think that the African Renaissance has begun? And I'm saying this based on two things. Number one, so we see in the Sahel, and we see former French colonies, because the French had French colonies had a different kind of colonialism. I think they had it bad compared to like the others. And but we see now, I think Africa's has joined, asking, you know, the French, you know, extricating themselves from French stuff. We've seen in this, I have former French colonies, you've seen coup and all of that. So do you think the African Renaissance have started, number one? And we've also seen again Africans, you see the Senegalese, the president, the younger in Senegal, demanding for the P5, the United Security Council composition to demanding a change. So that's number one question. The number two question would be, what are the institutions that are going to fight for these in Africa? So we talk about African Commission for Human Rights. We talk about your commission, sort of the different regional commissions. How are they well positioned to do this? Again, relating to also the trade, the African free trade that was known about at all the was that the African solution for Africa, whatever, the African agenda, yes. 60, 20 something. How is all that posed to put Africa in a, because I think Africa now is in a place where it has power, but I don't think we are leveraging that power. So number one, do you think there's an African Renaissance that is in process now with what's happening with former French colonies, and also Africa begin to make demands? And number two, what are the institutions in Africa, like, you know, African Commission for Human Rights, your at the regional level, are they really, really positioned to anchor this or facilitate this?
Yeah, there is an African Renaissance, but at the level of the youth in Africa have arisen, have awakened. They are woke. I know people use the word woke in a, you know, a derogative sense. No, these guys are woke. African youth are woke. You see what's happened in Mozambique. Yeah. You saw what happened in Senegal a long time ago. The protests that happened in Nigeria 2 to 3 years ago. You know,
in Kenya.
African youth have undergoing a process of rebirth. That is why in Mozambique, in Namibia, in Ghana, and so forth, the so-called liberation parties have been kicked out. In a democratic way, the liberation, you know, is a shock, you know. Yeah. In South Africa, the ANC, which is
ANC, lost a bit of some power,
substantial, you know. So the youth that are rising, you know, are woke. I don't know if the leaders are woke. I need to study it closely. I don't know if they are just pacifying the youth by their rhetoric. So the rhetoric is there. I was surprised with Ivory Coast. You know, I'm saying this in my personal capacity, not as commission. I was surprised to see Ivory Coast saying, you know, the French must leave. Because we know, as you say, the Francophonie relationship, Francophonie, very new colonial, you know, you know about the currency and so forth and so on. So I really don't know whether it's rhetoric or if they mean it. If I talk to some of my former students in those countries, they say, hey, we don't know whether we should trust these guys or whether they just return. You know? Some of them are military guys. We don't know, you know. So let's study, I mean, the Mali, you know, and that region. It has been going on for about 6, 7, 8 months. I want to give it a year first before I see whether it's rhetoric or whether they mean it. You know? Church is pulling out of Africa strategically. You know? So we don't know when President come and say, we demand you to leave, whether it's a show.
It's gimmick, you know?
especially Ivory Coast. I don't know.
I was surprised. I was surprised with the Ivory Coast one, to be honest. Yes, I was surprised with that.
So my short answer is that I really need to study it closely. I don't want to. I'm not an expert of that region. I need to study closely. But at the youth level, I know for a fact that these youth have. I used to teach, and also when I travel, I go to places where young people go, and I engage with young people. You know, we need to get rid of xenophobia first of all.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Places like South Africa. I say this in my personal capacity. Grappling with xenophobia in Africa. So you can't say away with colonialism, but you are xenophobic.
And there is xenophobia.
To your black Africans specifically, you know. So we still have to deal with some honest, you know, issues that we have. In terms of the African Commission and the African Court, the African Commission has gone by through stages. You know, where they were scared to hold states accountable. But I think the African Commission is doing its best in terms of using the African Charter on Human and People's Rights to hold states accountable. Similar with the African Court. I'll be going to the African Court session in February. They are trying, they're giving very good decisions against states that have violated human rights. And what is encouraging for me with the African Commission and the African Court is that they're starting to do more and more cases against big business. So not just against the state, but now against big business that are involved, you know, in polluting waters, in displacing communities, you know, in corrupting governments. So that tells me that they're interested in dismantling, you know, capitalism, because there's no decolonization with capitalism.
Otherwise,
you're playing a game. It's a game, you know. There's no decolonization with neoliberalism. You must choose. Nepal could not choose. Nepal said new partnership, but with neoliberalism.
You can't.
So that's why
I agree with you 100%.
So I'm very encouraged by the youth. I'm very encouraged by the African Court, the African Commission. Implementation remains a problem. So the commission like ours, the African Court, the African Commission, gives decision. Very good decisions. But who's going to implement them? You know, the African system works in such a way that if there's no implementation of a, you know, commission decision or a judgment by the African Court, you can go to heads of states to complain to them. And the heads of state must enforce the decision. The sense of brotherhood still prevails.
You said so many things here. But one of the positives that you've mentioned, and in my last book, because I was looking at I look at democracy, the militarized democracy. I look at Nigeria's current democratic republic and as a militarized democracy. One of the things I was looking at the youth is that the youth, women, they are the hope of that, not just Nigerian democracy, the continent. But also, I also recognize the adverse impact of neoliberalism. Adverse impact of our inherited kind of political system from Europe, and how that needs to change. And in my current research, I'm looking at how that is affecting, militarizing the society, the continent, and, you know, and undermining our democracy. But there's something you mentioned that I was going to take you on. The executives themselves that are supposed to implement this, the leaders in Africa, there's something very surprising. Is we all kind of defenders of this inherited arbitrary creation of states. For instance, you're talking about xenophobia, and we look at these states as states that are created arbitrarily by colonial masters. But we've been able to defend this, and there's that brotherhood, like you mentioned. that reluctance to hold another state accountable, because you know you don't want the same level of scrutiny to you, and that has head down the implementation of some of these good decisions that have been made. But how do you see that? Because we were coming to the end of the podcast now, I wanted to see, tie that to what do you project? So I wanted to end this podcast with looking at that. How do you see that changing? We see the youth challenging. We see in Botswana, we see in Zimbabwe, we see in South Africa, we see in Mozambique, we see these liberation parties, these old parties, we see them, you know, being challenged by newer stuff. How do you see, do you project in the next, from short to medium, long-term plan, how do you see Africa positioning itself to leverage its power and get the restitution that is due, and then be able to also leverage its power in the global scene, at the global stage? And I just wanted to conclude on, to just have like a broad, just have a broad 5 minutes to just, you know, wrap up with everything.
Well, my name is Tebo, which means hope. So I'm always hopeful. As I said, the youth give me a lot of hope and confidence. The decolonial 10 from 2015 onwards really has shaped things. More and more people are talking about decolonization, not just democratization, but decolonization of ourselves and of society. So the decolonial 10 that has, you know, and it's not just in universities, it's everywhere. We're talking about our own seeds, you know, seeds that you plant, seeds of sovereignty, for example. We're talking about the need to honor our fashion, you know, our music, you know, amapiano, you know,
Afrobeat.
Afrobeat. I don't like the name. We are the Afrobeat of Fela Kuti. We're not the Afrobeat of today. The Afrobeat, you know, globally, confident, not coping styles, you know, the diaspora, the relationship with the diaspora. That's my third point. African diaspora has awakened. African diaspora has really awakened, you know. African Americans, you go to Britain, you go to Latin America, there is that sense of pan-Africanism coming back. So decolonial turn at the African level, at the global level, a return to the pan-Africanism of W.E.D. Bois, Du Bois and others, or the negritude of you know, Cissé and others, you know? So the diaspora is also becoming woke. They insisted on, you know, natural hair, for example. Those might look superficial. You go to nightclubs, African-American kids are playing amapiano and Afrobeat. In the deep in the States, you'd be surprised. You're going to a are we back? Yeah,
we're back. Yeah.
So there will still be resistance from some of our leaders because they benefit from mental oppression of people, but also for material oppression of people. There will still be resistance from them. Unfortunately, there is going to be more conflict before we get it right. You know, people are dying in Mozambique, you know, because of the protests that are happening. People are dying in Kenya, which has been happening for a long time, by the way. You know, you remember even last year.
2007, yeah, last year, yeah. The finance bill.
Which looked like it was about, you know, economic issues, but there are also political issues. You know, in the end, you know, people died in Nigeria. So, unfortunately, you know, there's going to be more protest from the youth bottom up, not from political parties, but from organic social movements. You know, there's going to be more and more social protests and much more counter revolution from political parties, from political parties, from our leaders, you know. But eventually, you know, in the next 10 years, not 5 years, 10 years, we're going to start to see shifts where, you know, our leaders are very funny sometimes, you know. They change when there's, you know, pressure from above, from the World Bank, you know, all the traditional. Bottom-up pressure, global pressure, there's going to be change, you know. So I'm very hopeful that, you know, change will come. You know, the decolonial trend will take more and more momentum. It's a pity that at universities, decoloniality has become a metaphor, you know. The Pan-Africanism at the global level with the diaspora will, you know, congeal and become more and more strong. And all of that will come to, because the current system is unsustainable. It's unsustainable, you know. The levels of inequality, the level of injustice, the ecological destruction, you know. And I don't see a move back to militarism, you know, in Nigeria, in Lesotho. I don't see that. All I see is a movement towards more democratization, more decolonization. So I can't tell what's going to happen, but I'm very, very hopeful.
Yeah, I agree with you. I share your hope, Commissioner. And I'm very grateful, but I'm going to just respond to this. You see, you mentioned something. The university used to be the center for sparking consciousness. But I think what's happened, to answer that your question, is the elites, the academic elites themselves, have become complicit. And that's where you see that lukewarmness, because that used to be the center for where you have all this debate that then transcends into the society. But it's unfortunate. But there needs to be a revolution in the educational system in Africa. Well, you know, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed I know we could have spent the whole day talking about this.
I know.
But fortunately, you know, tell me, we're grateful to have you. So we would keep in touch, and hopefully I'll come to South Africa and we'll see what we can do.
Yes,
Yeah, definitely we do. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Please continue the work that you are doing. The work that you are doing is very, very important. As I said, not only for Africa, but also for the diaspora. You know, podcasts and social media are very, very powerful tools that we can do this. So, Doc, thank you so much, and may you continue the good work.
Amen. Thank you, Professor. All right, take care. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you once again for tuning in to our first episode of the new year 2025. Happy New Year. Join me as usual to thank Commissioner Tepo Madlingozi for his very, very rich discussion of what reparation means to Africans and African continent. So to join me once again, if you have not subscribed to this, subscribe to our channel, share this widely, and like this video. And I'll see you next. For now, stay blessed.